Well, hey, my name is Spence. I'm one of the pastors here at Mercy. So if you're new here with us, welcome. Glad that you're here with us. We are, this weekend, we're continuing a series that we've been working through together as a church that we're calling Relationships Real and Restored. We're taking a look at the different relationships that we all kind of operate in everyday life, whether that's a singleness, dating, marriage, friendship. In a couple weeks, we're going to look at broken relationships, parenting, all those different things. We're seeing how, we're seeing what the Bible has to say about them, and how the gospel not only empowers those relationships, but can bring restoration to them as well. It's been a good series so far, and one of my big asks of you is that you would be willing to really consider what God says in these different arenas, and then maybe kind of work it out with one or two other people, try and figure out what are some steps that you can take out of this. That's been my big request from you. Well, this weekend, we're talking about dating. We're going after dating this weekend, and I cannot tell you how excited I am for this message, because personally, I kind of celebrate and revel in awkwardness, all right? And there is nothing more awkward on the planet, I think, than the dating relationship and the dating scene. How many of you have ever been on a first date? Show of hands, first date. All right, how many of you, that was yesterday? How many of you, that's right now, and you're just realizing it? He invited me to church. What is this? Is this a date? Oh my goodness, what have I gotten into, right? One of those things. I often, every time I think about dating, my mind immediately goes to the greatest scene in cinema history in the last 30 years, and that would be one of the last scenes in the movie Dumb and Dumber. You guys remember this movie? Where Lloyd Christmas is going to confess his great love for Mary. And so everything you need to know about dating is actually right here in this scene. So Lloyd gets up the courage and he tells Mary that, I like a lot. Like, can't even get the words out, which some of you have trouble with that when you want to confess your feelings. They come out all weird, right? And then there's how she receives it. He says, all right, Mary, what are the chances that a guy like you and a girl like me, we're actually going to end up together, right? And then Mary, of course, gives the not good. And the music stops and everything. And then this is a great moment. He's like, well, what are the chances? Hit me with it. And she says, they're more like one in a million. And then one of the greatest moments that actually captures so well how some guys just don't get it when they hear no, Lloyd goes, so you're telling me there's a chance, right? And then that's the scene progresses on from there. You ever been there in that moment where your palms are kind of sweaty because you're about to ask a girl out or something like that, and you're hoping that you're on the same page, or maybe you're on the other end going, oh, we're nowhere near on the same page here, and he's about to find out. Look, I know, dating isn't easy, but I have good news for you. The Bible not only speaks to dating, I believe it gives a very clear and compelling vision for dating, one that I hope you see clearly today, and I hope that it'll kind of shape the way that you approach dating from here. Now, before I say anything else, married couples, I hope that you realize this is for you also. I hope you don't think your dating life stopped at your wedding. Right, when it comes to dating, the wedding's not the finish line. The wedding's kind of like the first mile marker in a marathon. There's a whole lot more still to come. So I hope you'll lock in and pull some things from here and put them into practice in your marriage. I hope it challenges your marriage, and I also hope it kind of informs and allows you to be a better family member to the single people here in the Mercy family. Today, we're going to be primarily in an Old Testament book called The Song of Solomon. Now, typically, when we preach here on the weekend, we'll go through just verse by verse through a passage of Scripture, and we'll be doing a book for several weeks together. Today, we're going to knock out the whole book, Song of Solomon, kind of look at it from a zoomed-out lens, okay? So if you have your Bibles, get them out, make your way to the Song of Solomon, or maybe your Bible has it, your translation is the Song of Songs. That's where you're going to be heading. Again, like we always say, we've got Bibles out there. Please take one from us, our gift to you, if you need one, all right? Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, is the book about romance in the Bible. For some of you who have never really read the Bible, listen, some of what I'm going to say is going to really surprise you. Like if you're one of those, like you know kind of the high water marks, the John 3:16s, maybe a couple others, but never really read it cover to cover, some of what I'm going to say is going to surprise you. I'll never forget the first time that I read through this book was freshman year of college. Some guys said, hey, you should do the Bible in a Year program. And I was like, so proud that I had to say yes. And then I found myself in Leviticus around February, just miserable. But then I worked my way through, and all of a sudden I got here and read Song of Solomon, chapter 7, verses 7 and 8, that says, and I quote from the Bible, "You are tall and slim like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters of dates. I will climb that palm tree and take hold of its fruit. What? I ran down my dorm hall to the guy that was in my Bible study. I was like, this is in the Bible, right? And immediately our desire to read and apply the Bible transformed overnight, right? For us, the big moment. This book, it's called a song. In fact, the very first verse, I'll throw it up here for you. Chapter 1, verse 1, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. The phrasing Song of Songs, it's a construction, especially in Hebrew, implies, hey, this is the best song. This romantic love song, this is the Bible's number one hit of all time, which is saying a lot considering all the poetry that's in the Bible. And the reason it is so powerful as to call it the best song is that the physical love described here between these two characters we're going to see in a minute, it points us also to the greater love that God has for his people and that he has created them to enjoy. So as you see over the course of our time this morning, a romantic relationship develop between two characters, there's also a second thing happening. That is, God is pointing you beyond the relationship of these two to his love for you. And we could do, look, we could do a several part series on this book. Maybe one day we will, but I want you to see kind of that big relationship develop as we go through it. But first, what you got to know is that the book kind of reads, if you were to actually sit down and read the thing, it reads like a play, kind of like if you had a script of a play. So there's two main characters, a king named Solomon, and then a blue-collar girl who works out in Solomon's field that's called the Shulamite woman. And this book kind of follows the development of their romance from that fateful first look all the way through into their marriage. All right, and I believe that this relationship we're going to see is kind of the picture or the paradigm that we need to construct a relationship that will carry us to our wedding day with joy. And by a dating relationship, I mean everything involved in the love, romance, even sexuality before marriage. Maybe you call that dating. Maybe you kiss dating goodbye and you call that something else now, right? Or maybe you come from a culture where your parents are the ones who set you up and decide who you will marry. Wherever you come from, here in this story are the markings of what your relationship should look like on your way to marriage. If you aren't experiencing all of these as God designs, then I think you're missing something and you're settling for less than what God intends for you. And so, I could have given you like 37 don'ts to do in dating, and that could have been the sermon because there's plenty of those, right? But I want you to see the big picture of how the relationship progresses and see this picture of what God has for you in the dating relationship. And I want you to evaluate your own relationships by it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to point out four markers of a healthy dating relationship that kind of come up to the surface when you look at this book and you look at this story as a whole, okay? So I'm going to jump right in. Here's the first one. We're going to call the first one the dance. The dance. The first part of this book is what you could call the dance. It's how these two strangers meet. It's the long gazing into one another's eyes. It's the romantic moonlit walks. It's falling in love. And it really is kind of a dance. It requires care, intentionality. It requires leading and following, all kinds of verbal and nonverbal communication. I mean, watch their two roles. You're going to see them unfold here right out of the gate. It's clearly a romantic relationship. Chapter 1, verse 2. Here's what she says. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out. Therefore, virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. Look, first thing you see, guys, this girl is attracted to this guy. I mean, she wants her mouth on his mouth, right? By verse 2, by verse 4, verse 3, your cologne makes me crazy. Verse 4, you start to hear the Top Gun soundtrack starting to play, right? Solomon, you big stud, take me to bed or lose me forever, right? What an incredible book of the Bible. I asked Courtney to memorize the opening here just for our own marriage. I'm kidding. But you look at verse 3, you start to see there's a little bit more happening too. Your name, it says, is oil poured out. All the girls love him because of his reputation as a man of good character. And ladies, this is what you are ultimately looking for. A guy that you are attracted to, who seems to bathe once in a while, and has great character, right? This is the guy. She's attracted to him. Now, what about his attraction to her? Well, verse 6, she keeps talking. She says, don't stare at me, though, because I'm dark. The sun has darkened my skin. My mother's sons were very angry with me. They forced me to care for their vineyard, so I couldn't care for myself, my own vineyard. And some of you guys are like, nice tanned skin. That's what I'm talking about. But she's embarrassed by it. It's a totally different culture today. In our culture, tan is attractive. In those days, it was bad. Cultural beauty standards have just changed. You know, the whole concept that she's talking about here, it's hard for us to understand in our kind of fake-baked Botox sort of culture, right? The point is, this woman is totally insecure about her looks. And that's a great snapshot of women then and women now. We live in a culture that is saturated with images of what a perfect body is supposed to be. They're designed, all these pictures, all these images, all these products that get pushed out at you are designed to make you feel inferior so that you go buy their products to then feel like maybe one day you could get to this elusive image that you're supposed to be. Not only does she not feel attractive, she's not really from the upper crust of society. Having dark skin was shameful because it meant she had to work outside, so she was poor. The fact that she said her mother's sons meant that her father's probably dead and this field would have been owned by Solomon. He would have leased it out to her brothers. And they were, when it says right there that they were angry, you know, the Hebrew word, it's a wordplay here. It says they burned in anger towards her. Just like the sun had burned her skin, her siblings had burned her. She's a working girl from a dysfunctional family who didn't have time to pamper herself or take care of herself. What does Solomon see in her? He's got all the palace hotties kind of lined up, right? Yet he sees something. He sees deep beauty in this woman. Listen, verse 9 of chapter 1. I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Don't be insecure, baby. To me, you look like a horse. Not what I would recommend, fellas, for how you would approach this. Obviously, culturally, here's the deal. Pharaoh's chariot was pulled by a long line of black horses, and he would always have one white one, and it represented the flawless strength of Pharaoh, and it could be seen from miles away. What he's saying is that she's one in a million. She's the standout. She's not ordinary. And then watch what starts to happen. Solomon really, he starts to recreate her with his words. Verse 10, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of jewels. And then she responds, the opening of chapter 2, no, I'm a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Basically, I'm just an ordinary, just another lily. And he replies, no, as a lily among brambles or among thorns, so is my love among the young women. You are extraordinary. Fellas, those are powerful words. I want you to see that's what he's saying with his words. I want you to see what he's thinking underneath. What's attractive about her? He sees her selfless devotion to her job, to a family that doesn't even love her. He reads her physical appearance through her inward beauty. Her inward beauty made her outward beauty much more beautiful. Guys, listen, when you are looking for a dance partner, to use our term today, physical attraction, sure, it's important. But you'll find it is not as important as spiritual attraction. Now, I'm not saying physical beauty is not important. It is. But there are things that make a woman more beautiful than her physical appearance. And our culture is screaming the opposite at you. It's screaming that physical beauty is paramount. The whole app, Tinder, and all the billions of dollars it's made is based on one thing, physical attractiveness. And it's a lie. There is a deeper beauty that actually intensifies beauty. Proverbs 31, I could list you off a dozen verses, but here's a couple. Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord, she's to be praised. 1 Peter 3, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Listen, a quick truth for some of you that are just too young, you haven't experienced this yet in life. Over time, physical beauty fades. All right? Things wrinkle. Things droop. Things sag. Things go gray. But deeper spiritual beauty actually intensifies with age, and it makes a person more attractive over time. Even people who are not Christians are picking up on this. There's a comedian named Aziz Ansari. You might know him by the name Tom Haverford, depending on what TV show you've watched. But he just released a book that's called Modern Romance. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's about how the next generation is dating. And he's not a Christian, and after surveying thousands, he came to this conclusion. Thought this was fascinating. He said, look, there are two types of love. After surveying all these people, this is what we see. There's passionate love, and there's companionate love. Passionate love is the love that comes first. It's when those feelings are very wonderful towards that other person and they're really intense, but those feelings simply cannot last. And what he says is most of us think when those feelings begin to fade, it's time to go find a new person to have passionate love with. But for those who push through passionate love, he says, over time, companionate love develops and actually proves to be the deeper, stronger, lasting type of love. Look, I promise you something right now. First time I saw Courtney, I was 15 years old, and we were on a boat in the Mediterranean on a school field trip. And it was like the angels from heaven came down and said, "This one is made perfectly for you." Right? And I was like, look, a goddess from Whitsitt, North Carolina is in my presence. I was very attracted. It was passionate love, right? Just attracted to her instantly. But over the years, y'all, I've watched her run after Jesus fiercely. I've watched her be the best friend to so many others that I could ever imagine. She's given me four wonderful kids, and you know what? She can't spend all day, every day pampering her body because she's sacrificing herself to take care of our family. She wakes up in the morning and she reads scripture. Y'all, there's deep beauty there that is far more attractive to me and makes her much more attractive to me than the day that I met her out in the Mediterranean. That's companionate love. It's a deeper, more stronger, lasting type of love, and that's the love that you really want. So men, if you want companionate love, you must think like Solomon. Do not ignore physical beauty, but find a woman whose inner beauty makes you see even her outward beauty through that lens. Let me summarize it this way. Godly attraction prioritizes spiritual beauty over physical beauty. And lastly, fellas, look, that's what he's saying, that's what he's thinking, I want you to see what he's doing. Let me read you chapter 2, verses 8 through 13. She starts out talking. She says, "The voice of my beloved. Behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice." Look, I want to pause. I promise. I know that sounds like he's a creeper, but that's not what's happening here. So guys, do not go staring into the windows of girls you're interested in. That's hoping they'll respond like this. They won't. They'll respond with restraining orders, okay? Verse 10, "My beloved speaks to me and says, 'Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. For behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth.'" He's talking about springtime, right? He's like, this is new love. The time of singing has come. "The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away." His first and last words to her are, "Arise, come away." You see what he's doing? He's wooing this woman. He's calling her out. He's asking her on a date. And that's his job, to chase, pursue, and draw the woman into a relationship. That's how God intended male and female relationships to thrive. Listen, it's a two-way street for sure, but it's the man's job to instigate and activate it, to lead the way. Why? Because, well, from Genesis 2 on, men are called to lead. It's Adam who's first on the ground and then Eve. And Adam sings over his wife and calls her, names her Eve. It's the man who leaves father and mother to go get his wife, not the other way around. Listen, by lead, of course, I do not mean dominate, boss around, intimidate, or any other stupid thing that men have done in the name of the Bible, okay? I mean to step out, to take a risk, to take responsibility, to listen, to love, to serve, and definitely, like I said, to risk yourself. Guys, I know that's scary. Because every time you step out, there's a chance that you will fall through the ice, right? You risk failure and rejection when you put yourself out there. You know that feeling, you finally get up the nerve to ask a girl out, like we kind of joked about with Lloyd, and she says no? It's horrible. The pain of rejection is deafening, but rejection's a part of life. It's a part of life. Maybe you never felt it because you grew up in a culture where everybody gets a trophy, right? But listen, sometimes you lose, and that's okay. Look, one of the most disheartening traits in a man, I want you to know this just as you're thinking about the woman that you'd want to pursue, one of the most disheartening traits in a man is cowardice. It comes out in things like sneak-a-dates. You ever seen these where you'll get, like, some guy will send an ambiguous text that's like, "Hey, you want to get coffee?" And she's like, "Well, what kind of coffee is this?" Right? Is this date coffee? Is this just hangout coffee? Or will there be others there? What am I preparing for? Who knows? Because he was too much of a coward to really ask you out. He hid behind a screen and three emojis and somehow tried to ask you out for coffee. Guys, You cannot create. I know what's happening there. What's happening there is you're trying to hedge your bet in case she says no, it won't hurt too bad. You cannot create a no-lose scenario when it comes to romance. Leaders take risks. And if you are too scared to risk your pride, then you are still a boy and you do not need to be dating anyone yet. Ladies, listen to me. If he texts you and asks you to do anything, don't respond. Guys, stop hiding behind text messages, okay? I know I sound old school in this, but consider going to her face, okay? You think it's nice? Go and talk to it. Or at least call her, okay? Put yourself out there and say to her, arise, come away with me. Or maybe a more culturally appropriate equivalent for our day, right? Something like, look, you know, I can just hear you just say it, you know, you seem awesome from everything I can tell. Would you go out on a date with me Saturday night to dinner? I'm buying. That's important. I'm buying. Look, I'll just go ahead and tell you, I'm training my girls. I got two little daughters, and I'm training them to expect courage from any guy that's going to be interested in them. Now, I will say, ladies, on the other hand, listen, if men are going to actually start having backbones, then we got to affirm and celebrate that, which means you got to have the grace in this to say yes or to say no with kindness and affirmation. That's kind of your role in the dance. When he asks you to dance, you can step in and be led, or you can graciously decline. You know, go a long way to hear, thank you for being clear and for asking me. That takes courage, and I appreciate that, and I'm not interested. And guys, if that happens, that's okay. That's okay. Look, this is one of those things I want you to see, hopefully by being a part of our church family. When we talk about being gospel-centered, you start to see how the gospel applies all over the place. And here's one very practical example. The gospel gives us freedom to fail. Because even if we fail, even if she says no, we are still loved by God. Which means Christian men should have more courage to try and date up than anyone else. She's out of my league. So what? You love Jesus? Yes? Ask her out. See what happens. What's the worst that can happen? Get some courage and ask her out. Now look, let me stop really quickly here, because I think it's a good moment to show you and remind you this whole dating idea is a picture of the gospel. That God came after you. He came for you. God the King came after the one discarded and helpless in the field. Except you were worse. You weren't of good character. You were the one who rebelled against him. You were the spouse who cheated on him with other gods. You betrayed him, and yet he still says, arise and come home. And the betrayal you committed against him, he didn't punish you for it. He took it on himself and he forgave you. That's the real dance. It's a picture of the relationship God is calling you into to come home to him. In the Bible, he calls the church his bride and says he's the groom because he has this deep love for us. And he leads, he sacrifices, and he gives everything else up for us. That's the first part of this relationship, the dance, the opening dance. It's not easy, but if you look for a guy or a girl of good character and then be courageous and intentional, you'll be on a God-honoring approach to dating. That's the biggest and most important one. If you get that one, the other three that are going to be much shorter, they'll all kind of follow in line if you get that one right there. But let me go for the next one, all right? Here's the second marker you see between Solomon and the Shulamite woman that is big for us. We're going to call it the line. The line. Listen to what the woman says to her friends after she's married. This is chapter 2, verse 6. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. This is a fast forward now to where she's in bed with her husband. It's a very intimate embrace. And then she pauses right here to warn her single friends about the moment that she's in. Verse 7. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. She says this three times. She says it right here in the beginning. She says it in the middle of the book. She says it at the end of the book. Which, listen, whenever the Bible repeats something that many times, it's the Bible's way of saying, listen, this is important. Pay attention. Here's the deal. She is warning her single friends that sex is powerful and that there is a great context that it plays out in. But don't wake it up until it's time. She's saying don't activate the sexual part of your relationship until you're in the place that it's made for, marriage. I want to say a couple of things, hopefully clearly and directly with grace. First, the Bible's abundantly clear that nothing does more to sabotage a relationship and nothing's more destructive to your own personal soul than sexual activity outside of marriage. Paul even says as much. The first letter to the Corinthian church, chapter 6, verse 18, he says, flee, run away, flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. What God is saying to you through Solomon, through Paul, through the whole Bible, is that there's something different and more damaging in misusing sex any way other than the way that God designed for it in the context of marriage. And while all sin, and look, whenever I say sin, I just mean choosing a different design other than God's design, choosing your way over God's way. All sin has the same spiritual consequences. It separates you from God. But some sins have more earthly consequences than others do, and this is one of those. See, in sex, two people become one, and inside of marriage, that's a life-giving thing. But outside of marriage, that kind of unbridled, fierce power can be destructive. Here's a simple way to think about it. If I were to take a piece of duct tape and just wrap it around your arm, it would adhere to your arm. That's what duct tape does, right? We wait about 10 minutes, and then I grab hold of that thing and rip it off. A couple things are going to happen. Number one, it's going to hurt you, and it's also going to take some of you with it, right? Now, imagine I take that same piece of duct tape and then go and put that on 10 other arms and do the same thing. Do the same thing, maybe 20 other arms, do the same thing. And here's what happens. What happens to the duct tape? The duct tape begins to lose its ability to adhere to anything. It gets to the point where it can't adhere. This is what sex outside of marriage does. It kind of corrodes your soul and then creates huge intimacy problems for your future marriage because it teaches that sex is about self-gratification, not about loving the other. By the way, guys, porn does the same thing. I can't possibly get into all that here, but some of you have been so conditioned by porn to see sex as this sort of instant self-gratification fix that you've already ruined your marriage, or at least created huge problems in a marriage that you're not even dating anybody yet. And here's one other thing I want you to notice here. When the woman warns about sex, this is interesting to me, she doesn't talk about it like a line you aren't supposed to cross. You notice that? Most Christians, I have this, had this conversation several times. It happens a lot in high school, but really all throughout. Most Christians, when they start to decide, okay, I'm going to choose God's design for sex, so I'm not going to have sex until marriage. And that's usually followed with, well, how far can we go? Like, should we not go around second base? What are these bases? Why are you playing baseball? But they just kind of ask those questions. Well, here's the deal. I think that's really the wrong question. How far can we go? I think it's the wrong question. To the Shulamite woman, the question isn't how far can we go? It's when can we start? It's not about a line to cross. Her advice is simple. Don't wake up the sexual part of your relationship until you can follow it all the way through. And then on your wedding night, buy some Gatorade and make up for lost time, right? That's just in the Hebrew. You guys didn't get that. Look, I know for some of you this is difficult to hear. Maybe for you, when you start to understand what God says about sex and his design for it, you start to think, you're realizing maybe you've broken that design and that command. You've taken a relationship somewhere it wasn't supposed to go. The question maybe you're asking is, what if I've already awakened love? Listen, let me tell you something so beautiful about this gospel message. There is great hope in the gospel because the story of it is God coming to broken, messed up people and getting down in the middle of it and bringing healing and restoration out of it. It was a great moment that I had about 4 or 5 years ago. There was a couple in the church that I was pastoring at, and they said they came to us after being around the church for a while, and they realized that they weren't Christians, and they decided they wanted to give their lives to Christ. They weren't married. They were living together. It's very common, of course, in our culture. And so we talked them through it, and they decided they wanted to give their lives to Jesus, and they're like, okay, what does that mean? And we're like, well, eventually, this wasn't the first thing we did, because we're not about behavior modification, we're about heart change, but they're the ones that ask the question. They're like, so what does this mean for us? We're living together and everything. And so we got to talk, and we're like, well, we believe there's great hope for your relationship if you choose to go that route. Maybe you guys choose to break up. Maybe you choose to stay together and pursue God's design here. And so they moved out, they got engaged and moved out like in the same weekend. We went through marriage counseling with them. And then they chose to operate by God's design here. And then I was the one that got to perform their wedding 9 months later. And it was one of the most awesome celebrations of God's redeeming, powerful love, both on them individually and then, in their case, for them as a couple. I don't know if that's going to be what happens to you and your relationship you're in right now, but what I know is that God takes broken things and mends them and makes them new. That is what he is in the business of doing. And you are not damaged goods. You are not too far gone for God to change your story entirely. And the thing that's going to be awesome is that when God takes your redeemed story and changed story, and then he uses it to show his love to someone else who's just beginning to walk that journey towards him. I've seen it time and again, and it can happen for you as well. And what you'll start to see, what I want you to see, is that his love for you, not only will it redeem you, it will prove to be better than anything else. You'll find that you were chasing after a substitute when he was the one who had the real thing. There's a guy named Jonathan Edwards, an old American pastor from a couple hundred years ago. He said it beautifully. Let me read it to you. It'll be on the screen. He said, the enjoyment of God is the only happiness with which the soul can be satisfied. To go to heaven fully to enjoy God is infinitely better than the most pleasant accommodations here. Fathers and mothers, husbands, wives, or children, or even the company of earthly friends, listen to this, they are but shadows. God is the substance. These are but scattered beams. God is the sun. These are but streams. God is the ocean. Some of you have been trading streams for an ocean. There's an ocean waiting on you. So listen to me, you're not too far gone. Today might be your wake-up call. You can find him better than anything you've been giving yourself to. He's the lover you've been looking for, and he is calling you home. The idols, these things that we tend to worship instead of God, they will give us quick pleasure fixes, and then they'll take and take and take from us until we're left with nothing. But the true God, he is the one that you can go to, and he will give you deep soul satisfaction, and it will fill your heart more and more. That's the love that you were created for. And it's still available to you. Let me give you these last two pretty quick. Here's the third marker you see in this relationship between Solomon and his girl. The third one is the friends. Now, you remember what I said, Song of Solomon, it's more like a play than a song. It has the king, it has the Shulamite woman, but then it has this group of people that is a little mysterious, don't hear much about. They're called the friends. These are her friends. These are the others who speak into her relationship. From the beginning, the friends affirm the relationship's a good thing. They affirm that he's a good guy for her. That's chapter 1, verse 4. They help guide the relationship on the road to marriage. They help get her ready. In chapter 1, verse 8, it's like bridesmaids around the bride. They're getting her ready to prepare her for her wedding day. When the couple is in conflict over in chapter 5, the friends help her see the good in her lover. She's like frustrated with him and she can't see anything good about him. In chapter 5, verse 9, they say, what is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? Say it again. What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? Basically saying, stop complaining. Remember what you found so attractive about him. The point I'm trying to make, guys, this couple wasn't alone. A story about a king and a shepherd girl is also a story about her friends and parents and family and a village. And they all had a voice with which to give input, wisdom, rebuke, clarification. Listen, for the first time in human history, here in our culture, dating is usually disconnected from family and friends. All right, how often do you see this? You see a couple, they'll get together and they'll kind of like go in hibernation. Like, where'd they go? All of a sudden you get an invite to be a groomsman in their wedding. Oh, okay, so I guess it worked out. You know, that happens so many times. This is cool. I learned this week that Orthodox Jews have a practice for matchmaking they call the shaduk. And friends and family, what happens is the friends and family suggest potential partners for single men and women, and then they meet and get to know each other. Now, the couple usually has the final say, but the shaduk is the thing that gets the ball rolling. Now, I'm not saying we're having a Mercy Shaduk Friday night right here, okay? Red light, green light, yellow light, none of that sort of stuff, okay? But if you will open your relationship up to people that you know and trust and give them a voice to speak into your relationship, it'll do very well for you. That means it means you have to open it up to scrutiny. It means you can't hide. You have to be honest with people about the good parts of the relationship and the bad. As a result, though, they will help you think straight. to help you make wise decisions, sidestep mistakes, and walk at the right pace and on the right path. Which, by the way, is another reason why I can't encourage you guys enough to get into a community group where you can have people. That's why we have our community groups, people from all ages and life stages, so you can have them walk along with you, especially some people that maybe have been there before. So here's a question that goes right back to week one. Who are your friends? Do they know your relationship, and do you trust them enough to let them speak to you openly about it, even in the times when you don't like it? Let me show you the last thing that we see in this relationship. It's really important, and that's the destination. This song, this poem, it builds towards something. The first three chapters are building towards the long-awaited wedding day. Look at how chapter three ends. This is awesome. This is what she's saying about Solomon. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his own sword at his thigh against terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. I don't know exactly what that means. Verse 11, go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. The whole thing has built to this moment where they're going to be married. And y'all, that's a great model for a healthy dating relationship. It has a beginning, it has a buildup, and it has a destination. It is going somewhere. And that somewhere is marriage. Look, I know you may not like this, but it needs to be said, dating just to date is pointless. It's a waste of your heart. It's a waste of your time. Dating, y'all, it's for a purpose. Every cup of coffee, every night at the movies, every conversation is either a movement closer to or away from marriage. That's the purpose of dating. Y'all, the Bible gives such rich depictions and teaching on marriage all throughout. And dating is the vetting process for marriage in our culture. Now, I don't think you need to stress out right now. If you're that couple that you just realized you're on your first date here this morning, chill out. It's okay. It's not something that has to happen in one day. Relax. Take your time. But I do think it means you shouldn't date until you're ready to get married. And I know, look, when does that mean? That's going to be different for everybody, all right? I will say I haven't met many people whose parents still have to drive them to school that are ready for marriage, all right? That said, I've met many college graduates who have no business dating anyone because they are not ready to get married. So yes, I know this seems extreme to some of you, especially, I try to say this kindly, especially those of you who are like serial daters. You always have to be dating someone. You always have to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and you're like, oh, come on, man, what's the problem? It's just dating. I kind of want to ask you, who told you that? Well, that's just how it is. Says who? God is offering a different narrative for your life, one far better than just having a girlfriend because it's the thing to do. I know it sounds like a bumper sticker, but it is completely true. You don't need a boyfriend or a girlfriend to be complete in Christ. So change the narrative. Marriage is a great and awesome thing, and dating is the on-ramp that we have to get there. Treat it like it has a destination. Don't just date to date. So, men and women, this means you need to ask a lot of questions because dating now has a purpose, right? You may spend your life with this person, so you got to ask some questions to figure out who in the world you might be one day spending the rest of your life with. Things like, what is your intention? Where is this going? Do you have a job? Do you still live with your parents? What do you believe about Jesus? Who are you voting for and why? Do you want kids one day? Do you have debt? Do you have insurance? Could you pay for your own funeral if you were to die today? Right? You need to know. You need to ask some questions and get to know this person. Well, I do not claim in any way to be a dating expert. I just want you to see through the scriptures God's great love for you and how much marriage is to be a gift God gives you as a celebration of that love and how life-giving dating can be if you will put the other person before you, if you will take that great picture of the gospel and put it into your dating relationship. Listen, some of you, I hope that you will look beyond this picture of Solomon and the Shulamite woman and see what God is telling you. That God, the king, came after you. He came after you, and that he loves you. And doesn't matter what your past is. It doesn't matter what your story is. That story has been written up to this point so that you will hear and see today his great love for you.